Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley Miller here with Doug Wells. We're in the studio here in Old Town Park City. Beautiful day here. Our first guest is author Alan Gannett. Recent research has shown there's a science behind increasing the odds of commercial success in any creative field, whether writing a novel or starting a company. What is called creative genius is really the ability to understand what Gannett calls the creative curve. That's the title of his new book, and he joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Alan.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from wonderful Washington, D.C.
We love our nation's capital. Exciting times happening there. Well, actually, around the globe, I think. Yeah. Well, let's first talk about your book, The Creative Curve, subtitle, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. What gave you this idea?
So, I'm a little bit stubborn generally, and my day job is I run a marketing analytics company that works with a lot of big brands you've heard of. And I would talk to these marketers at these big companies, and you know, they would say something like, well, I'm just not that creative. And for me, this is very frustrating to hear because I'd always been a big student of creativity and read a lot of the stories of creatives and some of the science there. And what you see in the science and the stories and the history is that, well, there's actually a lot of consensus that creativity is a learnable, nurturable skill. But I realize that this is actually very much not known and not believed in our culture. And so the whole goal of the book is to really present the argument and the case that creativity is something you can learn, you can get better at, and you can develop. And so the first half of the book is breaking down a lot of the myths around the sort of inspiration theory of creativity. And the second half is I interviewed about 25 living creative geniuses, ranging from billionaires like David Rubenstein, Michelin star chefs, the songwriting duo Pasek and Paul, who are behind Dear Evan Hansen and La La Land, and actually explaining what they did to become more creative.
Well, let's start by winning over the audience to your first argument that creativity can be learned, it can be nurtured, it can be strengthened. What do you tell people that doubt that?
So there's a couple different things to think about. The first is that when we talk about creativity, there's two different types of creativity we talk about. There's what academics call lowercase c creativity, which is just creating something new. Then there's uppercase C creativity, which is creating something that's both new and valuable. New and valuable. And it turns out that when scientists look at studies around creative potential, what you find over and over again is that creative potential and IQ are actually not related. You know, there's a famous study done by Lewis Terman where he took a few thousand public school kids in California, and he tested them for IQ, and he took the ones with a genius level IQ. He called them, by the way, his termites, which is kind of terrifying, and he started following them with surveys every 5 years. And even after he died, his proteges kept sending these surveys to them. And what they found by following these genius kids over their lives is that, well, they were pretty normal when it came to things like divorce and alcoholism, depression, suicide, but they were actually also normal when it came to success. There was, you know, retail clerks, mechanics, none of them became household names. None of them won Nobel Prizes. In fact, the only two kids who were tested who went on to win a Nobel Prize were two kids who didn't make the genius cut. And so when you actually look at the science, you see over and over again that there's a lot of consensus that IQ and creativity are not related, and that, in fact, we all have creative potential. There's one really famous study done in the 90s that found that 86% of kindergartners tested at creative genius levels of creative potential, but by the time they're in high school, it's in the teens. And so you see this over and over again, is that the actual hard sciences around creativity, they're pretty clear.
So when you're a genius, you're not necessarily due for financial success. That's probably not a new theory, but your theory is if you have that genius and you follow a specific formula, then you can have commercial success?
So it's actually even more sort of open-minded than that. It's actually that the idea of genius isn't actually necessary for creative success or creative achievement or creative genius, because when we actually look at things like talent and skill development, the research shows us that really anyone can become great at a certain talent or skill with the right teachers and the right methodology and the right type of practice. You know, Mozart famously is known as this child prodigy wonder kid who, you know, popped out of the womb playing the piano. But the reality of a Mozart story, for example, is that, you know, when he was 3 years old, his father basically told him, you know, Mozart, I love you, but, which you should never tell the child, you know, you need to become a great musician. And he hired him some of the best music teachers in all of Europe. And little Mozart proceeded to practice 3 hours every single day for the rest of his childhood. 3 hours every single day with the best music teachers in all of Europe. And so often what you find is that these sort of young prodigies really just started very, very early. And they typically started under sort of pressure or some form of pushing from a parent. And that same type of learning, that same type of intensity, you can really start that at any age. And that's in order to develop technical skill. But there's this second element. There's this element of, well, how do you create the right idea at the right time? It's less about just, okay, are you technically proficient? But, you know, if I painted a Jackson Pollock today, we probably wouldn't actually label it creative. We might say, oh, Alan's skilled, but that's been done before. And so there's this whole sort of rich contextual element to it, too. And to get that, what I explain in the book is that creative geniuses seem to have this very good ability to balance what human preference will be. And human preference is one of those things that we think of as this sort of organic, nebulous thing that changes throughout time. But actually, researchers really have a good understanding of what drives people to like certain things. And it comes down to these two contradictory urges we have. See, on one side, we are scared of things that are unfamiliar, things that are, you know, too new. We think, oh, this might hurt us. Think about when you were a prehistoric cave dweller, if you saw a cave you've never slept in before versus a cave you've slept in multiple times, you'd probably go the one you slept in before because the one you've never been in might have a snake. So we have this urge to hide from things that are unfamiliar, but yet we also have this urge. We also look for things that are novel, that are new, because they represent potential sources of reward. If you are a hunter-gatherer, you're always looking for new sources of food. And so you have these two contradictory urges, this fear of the unfamiliar and this pursuit of novelty, that are actually your brain's really elegant way of balancing risk and reward. It turns out that the things that we like the most are a blend of the familiar and the novel. They're familiar enough to feel safe, but novel enough to drive intrigue. You can think about the first Star Wars. It was a Western in space. You can think about right now, there's that whole trend around sushi burritos that are blowing up everywhere. It's, you know, these massive sushi rolls. We actually really do crave these things that are, you know, they're familiar, but they also have that little bit of a novel twist. And that's what it turns out that creative geniuses are truly talented at doing. It's creating ideas in that sweet spot of familiarity and novelty.
Well, let's talk about that pursuit of novelty. I love that phrase. One of the folks you talked about or you had a chance to interview for your book is David Rubenstein. A lot of folks may not know David. I'm in the financial world, so he's one of the heavy hitters. He's the co-founder and co-CEO of the Carlyle Group, which is one of the largest private equity groups in the United States. And you and he were in Aspen, and you had a chance to talk to him about his love of learning and how he likes to learn. What role does learning play in creativity?
So since creating new ideas is about creating things that are both familiar and novel, you need to always be bringing in two things. One, a source of information that helps you understand, well, what's already out there, what's familiar. And so when we talk about these great creatives, I think we talk about them as doers. You know, they're constantly producing creative products. But the reality is that actually the best creators are some of the biggest consumers of culture, because that's what allows them to actually learn what will be familiar. But then it also has to have that twist of novelty. So this is easy for people early in their careers with fresh ideas, but what you find is that the people at the top of their game, especially the people who are older, not to call David old, but he's in his 60s.
Careful.
You find that they actually are very, very focused on also bringing in fresh ideas and novel ideas. And so you see that a lot of these people at the top of their game are actually obsessed with things like reverse mentorship, where You know, David, for example, is telling me he's always making friends. He's always bringing new people in the fold, old, young, intergenerational, doesn't matter. The goal is to actually keep this ingestion of sort of new and novel ideas. Because when you're at that point of your career, actually the bigger thing you worry about is not being too new, which you might have it when you're earlier in your career, but it's actually being too familiar, you know, doing what you've done before. And that's eventually how, if you're running a big company or you've had this long career, that's how you can eventually become stale. And so you find that the best creators are actually some of the most open-minded, and they're the most willing to look for new ideas.
So, Alan, one of my favorite quotes, which poor Doug and Bob have probably heard me say over and over again, Henry Ford had said, if I had given people what they wanted, I would have made faster horses. So that's a great example of something that is new, but transportation is familiar, right? You have to get from point A to point B. He just came up with a new way of doing it. So you mentioned the creative curve is the point of optimal tension between the novel and the familiar. If I want to be a commercial success in my business, how do I find that optimal tension?
So there's a couple things you can do. I think one that's very practical and accessible for everyone is consume more and consume in a very, very narrow lane. This is not about going on Twitter and learning a lot about a little. It's you find that there's these studies and they find the best entrepreneurs, for example, they get their news and information from trade publications. They go very, very narrow. They're not reading about everything. So you have to become somewhat maladjusted, so to speak, in how you input information. That's one. The second, though, is it's also about how you consume. See, it's not just about, you know, watching Netflix and you'll become a great screenwriter. Actually, what you find is these great creatives, they consume in this way that's much more interactive. It actually borders on imitation. See, what they do is they actually break down the structure of these great creative works, sort of like turning them into Mad Libs. So you'll see that, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, for example, when he attempted to get a master's thesis, his whole thesis was around mapping out the story arcs of great novels, and he found there's these four recurring patterns that drove great stories. Ben Franklin, when he learned to become a great writer, took some of his favorite articles from The Spectator, a magazine back then, and actually outlined how they built their arguments, and that's how he learned to craft a great piece of argument. So you see this over and over again, but actually imitation, to imitate the structure of great creative works, is actually one of the key ways to do it, because by imitating the structure, you get that familiar baseline, but then creating your own twist or flair or content on top of that gives you that little bit of novelty that drives it forward.
If I can just interject there, you had given a great example in your book, and forgive me, I cannot remember the author's name, of an author who looked at romance novels and looked at the structure of romance novels. And we all know that everyone likes a happy ending in a romance novel, but she realized that there were no black romance novels. And so that was what she put the new twist on, and she was a huge commercial success. What was her name?
Yeah, Beverly Jenkins. She sold over 1.5 million romance novels, and you know, she'd always been a big, avid reader. She was a big consumer. She literally grew up near a library and read every single book in the library annex near her home in Detroit. And as she got older, she realized that she loved these books, and she had understood them and understood how they were structured, but there were no characters that were black. And so she was one of the first people to write an African-American-focused romance novel, which has become a huge, successful commercial category. And at the time, it was this huge thing. It was a breath of fresh air. It was familiar, but it had this novel twist. There was a 5-page spread in People magazine about her because it hit that right optimal point of tension that allowed her to really break through.
You know, another huge commercial success and people that played a strong creative role in it, you had a chance to interview La La Land, the folks that wrote the lyrics to the music for La La Land. And I'm looking up their names right
Patrick
now.
Patrick and Paul.
Thank you very much. You know, so much so commercial success, you don't get much closer to winning the Oscar for Best Movie, but walk away empty-handed than they did 2 years ago. But what did you learn about creativity from those two?
Yeah, so they're really interesting. So they had a good year. So they won the Oscar for their work on La La Land. They also are the team that created Dear Evan Hansen, and so they won a Tony. And then they also are the team behind the music of The Greatest Showman. So they're having a good 24 months. And you know, what's so interesting about them is that Benj Pasek and Justin Paul is, you know, they started working together in college. They're now in their early 30s. And, you know, they're radically different. You know, Benj is a sort of big thinker. He's all over the place. When you talk to him, he's constantly sounds like he's bouncing up and down, even if he's staying still. Justin, it's like when I was interviewing him, I had to constantly, like, redirect questions to him because it's so hard to get him to talk. He's very quiet. He's methodical. He's systematic. And what's so interesting is that, you know, I think a lot of people are scared to go into creative fields because they feel like they have all these gaps. They have all these weaknesses, these things they can't do. But the great creatives know their gaps, and they fill them with other people. And so, you know, Benj would not be as successful by himself as he is with Justin Paul, just in the same way, because Justin needs that source of sort of frenetic good ideas, and Benj needs that structure to drive his energy through and into. And so if they both viewed themselves like many of us view ourselves, which is, well, you know, I'm not enough of a, I'm not organized enough to, you know, be creative and have a career at it, or I don't have enough new ideas to actually create things great, neither of them would have started. But they realized that by filling each other's weaknesses, that's actually how they drove success. And so you find that the best type of collaborators are actually not people who are like you or similar or people you quote-unquote gel with, but actually people who are very different than you.
If you're just tuning in to Mountain Money, we're talking to author Alan Gannett. He wrote the book, The Creative Curve. Alan, part of what you're saying, honestly, depresses me a little bit because it makes it sound like there really is nothing new or original, that successful things kind of follow the same patterns. And I think about what's been new and original lately, and we were just talking about, you know, La La Land and Broadway. What about Hamilton? I think a lot of people would argue Lin-Manuel Miranda came up with something really original there. Or would you argue he followed the same formula as other successful Broadway shows?
Yeah, so the thing that's really important is that you start to realize when you look at this stuff is that really everything in creativity is a remix to some degree, right? You know, most movies you watch are about 2 hours long. They have an antagonist or protagonist. They're following some of these common structures that we've come to know and love when we watch a movie. So even if they're very different, or even if they have very new twists on how they do it, there's still an element that's actually very familiar and very common. And so, you know, Hamilton's a great example where, you know, Hamilton was definitely new and novel, but it also had a lot of the familiar elements to a musical. And so I don't view that personally as depressing, because I think as people, we, you know, we need to have some level of safety and familiarity to expose ourselves to something new. And that sort of gradual shift is actually really interesting. And so now, you know, hopefully you'll see that there's more opportunities for other sort of hip-hop-oriented musicals to come out, and people will be more open to those ideas, and people will be able to push that further, because Hamilton started with, you know, it's kind of sing-songy. It's not, you know, it's not pure rap. It's not any of that, right? And so you see that I think this gradual shift in culture that we experience is actually really important to getting people to try new things.
Yeah, Ellen, I love that example. Huge fan of Hamilton music. I'm a huge fan of musicals in general, in case you can't tell by the questions I'm asking. But what I like about Hamilton is I read the book that it was initially based on. And, you know, he came up with this inspiration for a musical, and I read it thinking, okay, it was kind of like a duty as an American citizen. I should know about the founding of our country and our founding father. It was a commitment. It was 20 hours on audiobook. But
oh,
it's just
God.
Interesting how different people can experience the same thing, and based on their backgrounds, based on their passions, can come away with very different inspirations. And I want to talk about the importance of doing things that take you out of your comfort zone. I noticed on your personal website, you've actually been on two game shows. And what was the impetus for that, and what did you take away from it?
So I was an only child of heavily divorced parents. Like, they were divorced when I was one, so I had a lot of time alone by myself. They were both working all the time. And so I developed a sort of predilection for reverse engineering things and trying to amuse myself. And so when I was 18, this had sort of graduated from like Legos and model cars and toys to video games to eventually I was looking for something new to sort of hack. And I had this moment where I was like, I think there was a TV running, and I was like, it can't be that hard to get on a game show, can it? And so I applied for like every single game show on the planet, and I got back an email saying that there was an open audition for Wheel of Fortune. And so I'd never actually watched the show before. And so I went and I watched a whole bunch of episodes, but not focused on the puzzles, but focused on who they cast and, you know, what were those commonalities. And I sort of quickly realized that really the only thing they were casting for was the ability to talk very, very clearly and loud, and then also being willing to sort of embarrass yourself a little bit. I was like, I can do that. And so, you know, when I got to the audition, I did an Elmo impression, and I talked very, very loudly. And they were like, and you're on the show. And so I got cast on that, and then I was sort of bemused by this whole thing. And so I wondered if this would work again for other shows. And so I applied for some more, and I got cast on this very silly MTV show that was like an early version of Shark Tank. And Nick Cannon was the judge. And unfortunately, for both of these, I got very good at getting cast on them, very bad at actually winning. And so I lost twice. And so it's a little bit of a sore subject, but I appreciate you, you know, bringing me those flashbacks.
So, Alan, you have the four laws of the creative curve in your book, and we've talked about consumption. We've talked about imitation. The last two are creative communities and iterations. Can you tell our listeners about those?
Yeah, so, you know, because there's this whole social phenomenon to creativity, because you're creating things that are actually valuable and perceived valuable by an audience, you actually have to get a lot of other people involved. And, you know, I think with creativity, we have this sort of frontman phenomenon where, you know, when you think of a band, you might think about the front person as particularly more important. They're sort of the face of it. But without the rest of the band, usually wouldn't be anything. You find this with, you know, I wrote a book, you know, my name's on the cover, but there's tons of people involved. There's agents, editors, proofreaders, copywriters, research assistants, feedback readers, all these different people. And those are all actually integral to the creative process. And so what you actually find when you talk to these great creative achievers is that they have lots of different people around them. And so in the book, I explain what are those different types of people and how do you actually go about getting them. And then the fourth law of the creative curve is data-driven iteration. So I think we have this idea that, you know, some aspiring writer is going to go rent a cabin in the woods and write their great American novel. Of course, it's a coming-of-age tale told in Brooklyn these days. And they're going to go, and they're going to go to this cabin and only going to come out once they write the end. But the reality is that the great creators understand how much of their job is about that contract with the audience. It's about getting that reaction from the audience. And so as a result, early and often, they're getting feedback and they're actually iterating on their creative product to get the ideal blend of familiarity and novelty. And you see this in the movie industry. You see this in writing. You see this in the book I talk about. I spent a day with the flavor team at Ben & Jerry's.
Yeah.
Which is a, you know, someone who is not very tolerant of milk, let's say, is an interesting experience.
They made you cry.
They made me cry. They, yeah, they're chefs, and they were making spicy lunch, and I just start tearing up in the middle of this very happy place. But what was so interesting to me was that Ben & Jerry's, it's this very data-driven process. They do surveys. They, you know, do all this focus group testing. It's a very, very iterative, methodical process, and that's how they consistently achieve such great outcomes. And it's tasty.
Yeah, Alan, we're going to have to wrap up here in just a minute or two, but I did want to ask you, first off, normally on the back of the book, the author lists a little bit about themselves, and it took a little bit of work, but I found out your undergraduate degree, you're just an interesting person. You have a political science background from George Washington University. And as we're talking and you're talking about these different experiences, you know, one of the things that I considered a huge compliment, you know, you've kind of lived your life as a Renaissance man. You've given yourself many different experiences. And I've occasionally had friends tell me, hey, you know, Doug, you're a Renaissance man, and I consider that one of the best compliments people can give me. What's the importance of these different experiences? I mean, your day-to-day job is, I would think, very different than what you learned in your undergrad as political science. Doing this book is also a tangent to your day-to-day job. Why are these different experiences so important, and what role have they played in creating you into the person you are today?
Great question. So I think I've always been sort of fascinated by the intersection of the right brain and the left brain and sort of where they meet. How can you apply sort of pattern rationality to things that don't look rational, right? Whether that's political science, whether that's marketing, whether that's creativity. And I think that's been sort of the common thread for me. And then I think my sort of over active levels of energy and ADD sort of drive me to sort of bounce around. And I think ultimately what it's led to is, yeah, I think I've been able to come to this place where I think I've realized that it's very possible for people to learn really anything. And I try and live that and practice that and do that myself, but also at my company I try and coach people about that. People who are my friends, I try and sort of push them to do that. But really I think, you know, you can view the world in two dimensions or you can view the world in three dimensions. And I think, you know, getting to that point where the world is 3D and you're able to achieve things you didn't think are possible is one of the key goals of our lives.
Okay, that's a great note for us to end on. Our guest this morning has been Alan Gannett. He is the author of the new book, The Creative Curve, How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan, it was a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks for having me.